Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Bissell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker, and my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital, DVD, Tubi, and Amazon Prime.
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has directed two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life, and I'm currently in pre-production of my third feature, Best Friends Forever. I'm a distribution consultant and producer's rep, and I used to manage Sundance's Creative Distribution Initiative. This week, we welcome writer-director Adam Cooper on the show to talk about his career as a screenwriter and making his first feature film as a director, Sleeping Dogs, starring Russell Crowe. After that, we play another round of You're the Expert. But first, Ulrich, how are you?
I'm doing well. I've got a baby here who wants to say words, so, excuse that.
It's okay.
But yeah, no, I'm doing well. I missed the Oscars on Sunday, which was bizarre. I just forgot that it was on and didn't, like, plan to watch it or figure out how to get ABC on my TV or any of that stuff. And so I just missed it. So I watched Napoleon instead, which was great. It was fun. But it was cool to see, like, who won and everything. And then, like, I think on Monday night, last night, it was on Hulu. I could watch the whole Oscars, like, the day later on Hulu for free. And so I was like, oh, let me turn this on. And I'm sorry, Liz, but, like, the monologue was way too long. Yeah, you know, it started out okay. It was just, like, it was just so long. And I feel like a lot of the jokes didn't really land so well. And, like, it was, like, an awkward thing between Robert Downey Jr. and Jimmy Kimmel that was, like, a little bit weird. Like he didn't want the attention, but then he gets on, I don't know, it was just kind of odd. And I don't know, then we got to the first award, I was like, okay, finally, we're going to see an Oscar get handed out. And then it's like Jamie Lee Curtis talking about just Jodie Foster for like 2 minutes or something. And I was like, what in the God in living hell's going on here? Let's get to the Oscar already. And I was like, I have to hear this four more times. And Beth was like, turn it off. And so we turned it off. But am I wrong? Was it great? Am I missing out? I did watch the Barbie, you know, Ken performance. That was delightful.
I just think it's so funny. Like that, those were the peak moments of the show. I thought it was the worst Oscars I'd ever seen, but I still, people say that every year and I defend the show every single year. But this one was just particularly boring. But I did think that supporting actress moment was wonderful. I love all the speeches. I love all the like long-winded stuff. That's what I want. I want more long-winded stuff at the Oscars.
Do they do that for every award or just for that one?
Just the main acting awards, which I loved, but then they just sped through everything else in order to make time for those things. And I just felt like it was without life. Like I missed like the Hugh Jackman musical number in the beginning, you know, that stuff. I love that stuff.
Yeah, I was like, that's exactly what I was thinking. When I was watching Jimmy Kimmel prattle on for 1 million trillion years, I was like, where is Hugh Jackman dancing?
Yes.
Where is Billy Crystal like redoing scenes from every movie? Yeah. Like, where is the fun, the splendor, the excitement?
It wasn't there this year.
Oh, my God. It's like the other year that really bothered me was when it was like a pandemic year. And it was like they were treating it kind of like a podcast. And they were like, yeah, now tell us, what are your favorite foods? And like, what do you like to do in your time? I was like, I don't care.
Oh, I remember they went from table to table and they were all, yeah, I remember those. Like,
who cares?
But I will watch every single minute of every single Oscars for sure.
Yeah, I'm going to watch the next year's for sure. I just biffed it this year. But yeah, I don't think I'm going to rewatch this one because it was painful. The part I watched, besides Ryan Gosling being charming and recreating that dance number,
that was awesome. Truly,
that was
awesome. Yeah,
beautiful.
Chef's kiss. I agree.
What's else going on with me? I wrote 2 more pages last night.
Yay!
Whoop. I didn't really write at all between now and this week or last week, which is funny. It's just like we talked about before. It's like the podcast shame.
It's shame.
It's making me write. Mm-hmm. So it's good, but I'm so close now, Liz. I'm in the middle of the action sequence. I got like all like the business. It's really complicated, this movie, because it's like I set up things in the beginning that happened that have to happen in the end. So I got through all the business that I've already written in the beginning of the movie. So like everything has timed out the way it's supposed to make sense to the earlier scenes. Now it's like I just get to have fun for the last whatever. But I'm trying to decide, like, do I want this to be like a long sequence of action, or is this going to be just short and sweet? And I feel like it's a low budget movie, man. Like I'm probably not going to be able to do half the things I've already written in this thing. So I might as well just make it short and sweet.
No, write the dream version and then cut it later. Alric, don't fine. Censor yourself now.
Yes, ma'am. I'll write the dream. I'll write the long version. You got it. And then I'll cut it later.
Cut it later when you know you don't have the money. But right now you might have the money. It might happen. Hold out hope a little bit, I think.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's good. And then, oh, I have to talk about this. Oh, it's not, there's nothing final. It's not a big deal. It's not like, you know, a big thing, but a friend of the show, Amy Taylor, reached out to me yesterday and said, hey, you mentioned on the show a while ago that you would want to edit a short, maybe to like lead into editing features. And she's like, I'm making a short in the summer. Would you consider editing it? And I was like, hell yeah. So she sent me the script this morning. I can't wait to check it out. Yeah, I don't know. It was just really a delight to get an email from her, you know, and she was so sweet. She's like, I don't know if you know who I am or you remember me. I'm like,
we only talk about you every week, Amy.
Yeah, Liz brings you up every week and you are on the show, I think, actually twice. I think she was on for a short film way before and then she was on for her feature probably. Or something. Yeah, so I, yeah. But anyways, friend of the show, Amy Taylor. So yeah, but it was very sweet. And yeah, I'm excited to read it. It's a horror short and I love genre. So like I've never edited a genre movie for someone else before. Mm-hmm. Oh, I was a producer on one that I co-edited, so I guess that kind of counts. But anyway, so it'll be fun, but that's exciting. So what's going on with you? That's what's going on with me.
I'm at the point of accepting that I'm going to crowdfund for this movie.
Oh.
So I'm meeting with Kickstarter next week and I already have the person who's going to shoot and edit my video, my pitch video. We know the budget for that. I have to write the script. It's just like a really unfun, and I love crowdfunding. Actually, I'm one of the very few people who love it, but it's just a recognition that it's going to be really awkward for the next few months. And one of the reasons, and I think I'm going to disband my Patreon campaign prior to the Kickstarter campaign, because I don't want to double dip. I think there feels like a little selfish doing both. And then I'm getting really sensitive when people leave my Patreon. Like there'll be people who have been as part of the Patreon campaign for a year and they'll leave. And I know that they've been so kind and supportive for a year, but I can't help but like obsess over why they've left. But with Kickstarter, it's like you either donate or you don't. You're not going to like... Ooh, you can't like undonate. You know what I mean?
Right.
And I think I'm
can't leave you.
Can't leave me. I'm feeling abandoned because of the Patreon. And I'm also noticing, and this might be a longer conversation another time, but there are some people who participate in the Patreon who just kind of like take over the room sometimes. And so I'm working with one of my friend Aaron, who works in video games, on how to create more of a community rather than just a resource for individuals who are brave enough to participate. But how do I like pull out the quieter, shyer people? So that's what I'm thinking about right now, is community building, crowdfunding, creative financing, and closing the Patreon campaign to a degree, but still documenting the making of this movie.
What are you going to meet with Kickstarter about? Like, what is that meeting? Because I don't think I ever did that one before I did my crowdfunding campaign with Kickstarter. I don't think I had like a meeting with them. I just launched it.
I was the point person for the relationship that Sundance had with Kickstarter.
Oh, nice.
So I know them really well. And so the hope is that I can familiarize them with the campaign. Hopefully they'll be able to promote it internally and externally and give me some good advice on how to make the biggest splash with it.
Nice. That's awesome.
Yeah.
Wow, I should do that kind of stuff. Reach out to people.
Well, Cedar Spark had consulting. I'm sure you did some consulting.
Yeah, no. I definitely did. Yeah, Cedar Spark was great. I definitely had some meetings with them before we launched and like talked about the process. And they were very supportive and they thought what I was doing was great because I basically followed their game plan. So, you know, I think they were it was what they wanted to see what I was doing. But yeah, that's exciting. I don't know. I feel like crowdfunding is one of those things that's like, I get frustrated sometimes because I'll see people do crowdfunding campaigns for movies that are like backed by distributors and studios. And I'm like, are you serious? Like, you already have your distributor, you already have like a production company, and yet you're going to do a crowdfunding campaign on top of this. This is like your third or fourth movie. And you also did crowdfunding campaigns for all your other movies. It's like, dude, like, I don't know. It's almost like it feels like sometimes these companies see it as like a way for them to like get part of the financing done without them having to bring in their investors. And it's like it should be reserved for people like you who like are actually raising the money because you couldn't get investors into the you don't have the partnership. Yeah, I don't know. Anyways, rant over. But yeah, I just saw one. And it was for a movie that was a remake or a continuation of a franchise from the 70s. So it's like even more frustration. Like what? Like that needs a crowdfunding campaign? Really, guy?
Well, but what a great segue to promote our Patreon campaign for the podcast. So I may be closing my personal Patreon, but the podcast does subsist and survive thanks to Patreon. Patreon.com/MMIH podcast. And without any more delay, here is the chat that Ulrich and Eric, our producer Eric Toms, had with Adam Cooper.
We're here with Adam Cooper, writer director of Sleeping Dogs. Give us the elevator pitch for Sleeping Dogs, Adam.
Sleeping Dogs is the story of a former homicide detective named Roy Freeman, as played by Russell Crowe, who is struggling with Alzheimer's, and he's undergoing an experimental protocol called deep brain stimulation, which is meant to help stimulate dead or dying neural pathways. And against that backdrop, he's approached about a case from his past that he does not remember, where a college professor was brutally murdered 10 years prior. And Russell's character and his partner, as played by Tommy Flanagan, were responsible in finding the man responsible and putting him on death row. Upon seeing that man on death row, he tells him he did not commit the murder in question. And Russell's character, as sort of a mental exercise, begins to reinvestigate this case from the past, but it's almost like he's investigating it for the very first time.
And then roughly how many days did you shoot?
I can tell you exactly how many days we shot. We shot 30 because there weren't any more.
And what was the rough budget, if you can say, of the film?
I think it was probably 16 and a half.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
But it wasn't 16 and a half on the screen.
Sure.
Right.
That was inclusive of above the line.
Mm-hmm.
Above the line being actors, writing fees, producing fees, all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm. And what was the origin of the idea? How did this all come together?
We were brought a book in 2016 in galley form called The Book of Mirrors. It was written by a Romanian thriller author named Eugene Chiravici, writing in English for the very first time. It was brought to us by a guy named Puya Shabazian, who's a lit manager and producer, who we met on the set of Allegiant. He represented Veronica Roth, who wrote those books. Read it as a galley, which is a pre-publication print of it. And the book had sold at a big publishing auction. There were like 9 bidders for the rights to the book. Optioned the book out of pocket and wrote it on spec. And then partnered up with a guy named Mark Fasano at a company called Nickel City Pictures. He re-upped the option because it was getting expensive. And we became equal producing partners on the project.
Wow. Lots of questions there. How long did you spend working on the film from like the moment that you optioned the story until now it being released?
7 years.
Wow. Nice.
Wow. Yeah. Sticking with it. Good on you.
Yeah. I mean, it has its sort of peaks and valleys as it relates to the amount of time that is being devoted at any given moment. Because at a certain point, you know, this was a case of, it wasn't going to be a studio movie. So the way that it was going to get made was by getting an actor, and the process of getting an actor is its own lengthy quagmire.
Yeah. Well, now you're on the other side of it. You know, you've gone through production and post and all that good stuff. If you could go back and change one thing, what do you, in any way, what would it be?
I probably would have, that's a really good question. I'm trying to come up with just one thing. I probably would have fought for more prep time, you know?
Yeah.
You know, because I think, you know, there's, when you write something, you're not really initially thinking about the practicality of what you're writing, you know? And you don't really have awareness around the practicalities or the achievability of those practicalities until you're actually on the ground wherever you're doing it. And in the case of this film, we were shooting it in Melbourne. I'd never been to Melbourne. I didn't have any familiarity with Melbourne. So there's a vast learning curve as it related to locations and crew and, you know, yeah. So probably more prep time.
Yeah.
How much prep time did you get on the film?
I mean, we probably had, there was probably like 2 weeks of soft prep, which included like me just showing up in Melbourne and getting settled with my family.
Mm.
We had to push a couple of times because of various things that would come up. But I guess we probably had maybe close to 8 weeks, but it was separated by a 2 week Christmas break. Because I got to Melbourne basically November 18th of 2022.
Oh, wow.
So right around Thanksgiving. So I basically had about 4 weeks, and then we had a 2 week break. And right before the 2 week, right the day before Christmas, I lost my DP.
Oh gosh.
Who I had spent all this time formulating look and scouting locations and, you know, sort of building it. And then I was, you know, you don't realize that these things are blessings when they happen sometimes, but it was definitely challenging, especially being a first time filmmaker. I was, you know, really leaning on my DP. Anyway, the guy who shot the film, a wonderful human, a guy named Ben Knott, came on. And then I had basically 3.5 weeks to bring Ben up to speed, to rescout all of these locations.
Wow.
You know, so it was definitely challenging.
I'm not sure if this is a sensitive issue, but like, can you speak to like why you lost your DP or how that came about? And then like, how you pivoted to finding a new DP so quickly?
Well, I had interviewed a bunch of DPs prior to choosing someone. And as a first-time filmmaker, some of the insecurity I had was around camera, right? Mm-hmm. Not so much that I didn't know what I wanted, but knowing how to effectively translate what I wanted. The DP I had chosen, he kind of had a consistent look across his work. So I knew that even if I wasn't able to effectively translate exactly what I wanted, I knew that I could just fall back on knowing, well, I know what I'm going to get, right?
Yeah.
I think that he was a DP who had done a lot of commercials and a lot of big commercials and was used to working with a lot of toys and a really big budget, right? Mm. And we had constraints and we were going to have to move fast. You shoot a 10-hour day in Australia, that's inclusive of lunch. So you're at a 9-hour day. And he wanted it to be a single camera shoot. And had we shot this movie single camera, we never would have made a day. And I think at a certain point in time, he realized that maybe he didn't have the resources at his disposal to do it the way that he would want to do it. And I had met, so ultimately then the DP that I worked with then, it was somebody that I had met in the process of looking at DPs.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't that, I loved Ben's work. I thought it was fantastic. I made the wrong call. And I'm so grateful to Ben. I mean, he's the only DP I will ever work with.
That's terrific.
He's fantastic. I mean, I don't know if you guys have seen the film, but I think he did a beautiful job. So
yeah, unfortunately, I haven't had a chance to watch it yet. So,
well, I wanted to ask, I mean, you've had a pretty amazing career as a writer. So was this always the plan to make this your first feature writer director project?
No. I wanted to be a director. And when I was in college, I wanted to be a director. I went to the University of Michigan, which at the time I went there wasn't like one of the, the benchmark schools for filmmaking. You couldn't even rent a, like, they didn't have like a, like, I couldn't go like rent a camera. I had to go to like a Detroit camera house to rent a camera to make a short film my senior year. I think when I was in college and
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You know, I knew literally one person who had anything to do with the film business. My cousin was married to a guy named Jeffrey Brown, still is. It's really my mom's first cousin. So Jeff's a bit older than I am. But Jeff had won an Academy Award for a short film. And so I remember talking to Jeff about, like, how do I become a director? He's like, well, there's people who direct commercials. There's people who direct music videos. There's people like Hal Ashby, who started in post-production as an editor. And then there's people who write and eventually direct, right? Or direct the things that they write. So I kind of took tastes of each of those ways. I was never a guy who, like, I wasn't like J.J. Abrams or Steven Spielberg, who was running around as a kid with an 8mm camera, you know, and, you know, taking my action figures and, you know, making stop action short films. My dad was a doctor. And for a long time, I think I thought I was going to be a physician. And I didn't really discover my interest in storytelling until I got to college. But I spent one summer at NYU's Sight and Sound program. I spent a summer in Los Angeles working in post-production on the Hulk Hogan movie, Mr. Danny, I think it was called, or something like
yes,
that.
Yes, it was. Yes,
one
it
of
was,
my
sir.
Favorites as a child, I have to say. No.
So, and then I started writing in, I guess it was maybe my junior year of college. And I was thinking less about directing by then and more just about trying to get away, my foothold in the business. How do you get in? So I was writing. I got a job right when I graduated high school working for Scott Rudin.
Wow.
In New York, where I would commute from my parents' home on Long Island. And I worked for Scott for a year and sort of got front row seats on kind of the development process, right? In both sort of the optioning of IP, books and plays.
You were working as an assistant?
I started working as an assistant to the guy who ran the New York office, who was a guy named Raymond Bongiovanni. And the guy who was the creative executive, as would often happen, was unceremoniously fired. And Scott said, hey, you want to be the CEO, the creative executive? I didn't know anything. I was like, okay. And so it was my job to read scripts, do coverage, go see off-Broadway plays. And I learned just a lot about, you know, kind of the way the business worked from a development side. And then I moved, after a year, I moved to Los Angeles to work for my cousin, Jeff Brown. He'd started his own company and he was developing some independent features. And I worked for him. And I was also reading scripts for William Morris long before it was ever William Morris Endeavor. And so I got a real education in writing through reading a lot. And then, you know, just started writing scripts. And I still harbored directing aspirations, but I wasn't pursuing them. And then there was this script called Living Legend that Universal was going to do. And I was attached to direct that. And that was likewise a story about identity, discovering who somebody really was. That was it was loosely based on an old Gerard Depardieu movie called Le Retour de Martin Guerre, The Return of Martin Guerre, which had been remade as Summersby by Michael Apted, starring Jodie Foster and Richard Gere. So I was attached to direct that. But a long-winded way of saying, no, Sleeping Dogs was not, it wasn't like a bright idea at the moment of, oh, I'll direct this. Like I'd always wanted to direct, but a lot of what we'd written wasn't stuff that I was keen on directing. It was like either just unattainable in terms of the scope of what those movies were, or it just wasn't something that I wanted to live with for a long time, which is something you have to do as a director. Like when you sign up, you're signing up kind of for life.
Yeah.
And so I think with this one, it had a really compelling sort of mystery component to it. It was contained enough. It was sort of a singular character's journey. And it felt like a story that I could tell, that I could put a bit of a visual stamp on as well, given sort of the nature of the subject matter and the genre in which it existed, it being sort of a neo-noir type thing. So that's kind of how it happened.
So it was like you did find this story, and you're like, you were immediately attracted to it as a director. Like, this is going to be my thing. That is my first feature, sort of.
Yeah. I mean, I'd read the book, and I really latched on to the character that Russell plays, Roy Freeman character, who actually only exists in sort of the third part of the book, because it's broken down. It's like three different characters. There's a New York lit agent, there's a New York investigative journalist, and then there's this homicide detective who investigated this case 25 years ago in the book. And I thought, you know, the story is very much a story about memory and how memories of things past aren't always the way that they went down, and that truth is oftentimes a point of view. And I thought it was really interesting. I thought it'd be interesting to lens the whole story through the eyes of a character who was bereft of memory, because it gave him an arc, right? There was some place to go with that. Whereas the other characters, because they weren't responsible for putting this man in prison, there wasn't any culpability for those characters. Ultimately, they were objective. So yeah, I was compelled by the character journey first and foremost.
And then a quick like follow up to that: how did you get Russell Crowe attached? Because if you're a first time director, you know, and yeah. I mean, you've written a lot of amazing movies, and you have a lot of credits and all that stuff. But like, that still is a pretty big jump for your first feature to have such a big star, you know, as your lead. So can you just talk about how that came to be?
Sure. So I think the script was finished probably around 2018, and you know, you make lists of people who could play the part, and Russell was always very, very high on the list, and I never thought he would be somebody that we could get. And we kind of went through that process of submitting the script to his agent and to other agents when you don't get feedback or a response, and went down the road with another actor, incidentally, and had a hard time getting the film made. And I got busy writing other things while Mark Fasano, my producer, was trying to get the movie made. And one day he calls me and he said, hey, we're going to submit the script to Russell Crowe. My then agent, a wonderful guy named Daniel Cohan at ICM, used to work as Russell's then agent's assistant at William Morris. And then Daniel went on to become an agent of his own and my agent. And Russell's then agent, George Freeman, went on to become a manager. And my agent, Daniel, was still very friendly with George. So he sent the script to George along with, and it was backed by a financial offer, because we had a foreign sales company that basically said, if you get Russell Crowe, we can deliver the territories to support the offer. And so I was sort of like, yeah, like that's going to happen. And then like, I don't know, 6 weeks later, I got a phone call that said, Russell read the script. He likes it. He wants to meet. And so then about maybe 6 weeks after that, I had a Zoom with Russell, and the connection was really bad with Australia over Zoom. So
I saw
him for like a quick flash. And then he was like, he texted me saying, hey, can we just do this as a call? And so we talked, and he liked the script. He liked the journey of the character. He hadn't played a part like that before. And we had a pretty like sort of forthright conversation where I said, I'm a first time director. I'm not going to pretend to know things that I don't. And he says, I'm not a first time actor. I've been doing this a long time. And I'm not going to pretend to not know things that I don't. And he was a great ally because of that, sort of in the filmmaking process.
Now, to kind of get an idea of, I mean, you keep saying first time director, but I mean, like, had there, I guess it's kind of two questions. Had there been anything that you'd made before this, any, you know, shorts or things like that, you know, when you were in college or when you were doing other stuff? And also, like, did you, you know, it's great that you had the backing, this financial backing, you know, you get, but in order to get those things, did you have to prove to everyone, like, hey, look, if you guys give me the money, I can do the job, and here, look at this, you know, like, did you have some sort of?
I did not prove that I could do the job by offering up a filmed piece of content that proved as much.
Gotcha.
I could speak about the movie confidently, and I could speak about the visual language of it confidently. I hired a really talented graphic artist named Joel Chang, who my friend Michael Gracie had introduced me to, who did all the concept art for The Greatest Showman. And so I had him do concept art for me. And it was really more meant to evoke tone than anything else. I think that because I was able to convince Russell, I think it made it very easy to then convince anybody else. Because I think at a certain price point, all people care about is, well, if you could get the actor to do it, then okay, we're on board. And then it really, for me, became about surrounding myself with people who were much smarter than me, who've been doing it much longer. You know, I had the benefit of having Ben Knott, who's probably 10 years older than I am and has made a lot of movies and was unfazed by what was ahead. I mean, it was challenging, but he'd clearly been in the trenches and challenged before. You know, I had Matt Vila as my editor, who was Baz Luhrmann's editor, who was nominated for an Academy Award. David Hirschfelder was my composer. He was nominated for an Academy Award for Shine and for Elizabeth. So I had a lot of people around me that I could really lean on. And I tried not to pretend, like I had said to Russell, that I knew things that I didn't. And it kind of freed me in a lot of ways.
That's awesome. How did you get that level of crew on an indie film? Was it just through personal connections, or how did that kind of come about?
So there's tons of great craftspeople, department heads in Australia. I mean, Ben Knott is an amazing DP, and there's an incredible assortment of incredible DPs in Australia. One of the first things that happened brought on our line producer, a woman named Deborah Glover. Deb was, a Melbourne native. And so we leaned on Deb as it related to some of sort of the initial hires. I mean, it's how we found Ben. Penelope Southgate, who was my production designer, is how we found Penny. Costumes, a guy named Zed Dragojevich. Makeup was a woman named Helen Megalaki. Many of them were people that Deb knew or had worked with previously. They weren't attracted to any light that I was casting off. They were, I think, initially attracted to the opportunity to work on a Russell Crowe movie. And then once I started working with Russell, Tommy Flanagan is in the movie because Russell and Tommy worked together on Gladiator. Matt Vila is my editor because Ben Knott, my DP, had worked with him on two films that the Spierig brothers had directed that Ben had shot. And Ben and I were driving to set one morning. We were talking about editors that were being presented to me. And he's like, you know who should edit this movie? I'm like, who? He's like, Matty Vila. And I'm like, okay, I don't know who that is. And he's like, he's Baz Luhrmann's editor. And so as we're driving, he called Matt on the phone. And Matt Vila is the world's loveliest man.
Wow.
And Matt was like, well, I have a window. I'm available. Send me the script. And so we did. And he wanted to do it. And so he flew down to Melbourne and we met on a weekend. Wow. David Hirschfelder, the composer, I was at Russell's house one weekend. And in the evening, in the house that he was renting there, he had like this big bar in the basement. And there was a grand piano. And when I went in with my wife and we went and sat at the bar, there was a guy playing the grand piano. And it was David Hirschfelder. And I didn't know who David was because short of like, you know, Jerry Goldsmith and John Williams, like I don't have a deep knowledge bank of composers. And, David sat down at the bar next to me, and sweet, soft-spoken guy. And we talked for a little bit. And Russell said, yeah, that's David Hirschfelder. And he lives in Melbourne. And he was at Russell's house because Russell had directed this film called The Water Diviner. And David scored The Water Diviner. So Russell said, David, you should do this movie. And that's how that happened. So, a lot of luck.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Well, now, kind of going back in time a little bit, can you talk about in the beginning, how did you first land your first writing gig with New York Minute?
Well, my first writing gig was actually I'll Be Home for Christmas, starring Jonathan Taylor Thomas.
JTT.
So I wrote a lot of movies with Bill Collage, and Bill and I met at the University of Michigan, and I moved out to LA, and Bill was working in New York, and we were kind of working bi-coastally. And we had our first agents, and we were at our agent's Christmas party, and it was a small boutique agency. There were three agents there, and we were at our agent's Christmas party, and we didn't know what proper etiquette was. We didn't know that you were not supposed to drink your face off. And we found ourselves sitting in one of our agent's office, and her girlfriend was the director of this Jonathan Taylor Thomas movie that had yet to go into production. And they needed production rewrites on the movie. And Arlene Sanford thought we were really funny. She hired us to do the production rewrites. Now, we had written some things on spec, so we had some samples, but we hadn't sold those things. So that was kind of the first job. The reason New York Minute happened was because we had been hired to do a rewrite on a project called For What It's Worth, and did a really good job on the rewrite. And it attracted the interest of a director, and they were sending it to actors trying to get the movie made. And so Warner Brothers liked us at that time. And the producer who we had developed For What It's Worth with also happened to be doing New York Minute, the Olsen Twins movie. It was offered to us to write it from scratch originally, and didn't feel like something we wanted to do at that moment in time. And then once there was a script, it came back to us to rewrite it, and we were busy doing other things. And then it went into production, and it still needed work. And that's when we got on that project. Hmm. This is also a different time, though. And I don't know that the business exists in this way anymore, unfortunately. We were very fortunate to kind of go from job to job to job. And it wasn't always linear. Like, there were oftentimes gaps where you felt like you were never going to work again, and those gaps don't go away. I think like the rarefied few who I think have that experience, but that was the way that I got into it.
Can you speak a little bit more to what you just said about like how the industry isn't the same? Like, is it just because like studios aren't producing as many movies internally and it's like more independent movies are being made, or is there just not as much work in some way? Like how is it so? Because to an average person, it's like, oh, there's 1,000 million TV shows being made, and there's like, plenty of movies coming out all the time. So it doesn't really feel like there's less content. But like, mm-hmm. from what you're saying, it sounds like there's somehow less opportunity. But like, can you just speak to that a little bit, like what you mean about the difference between now and then?
I think there was a time when you could just come up with some original idea, write a spec, and take it out and sell it. I don't think that exists so much anymore. I think that even before sort of the streamer business got big, I think that companies grew more risk averse, right? So they wanted, and I think to a large degree still do, want to be producing content that's already been proven in another medium, right? Stuff that there's brand awareness around, right? So from a marketing standpoint, you have to work a lot less hard because the brand already, in the best case, already has 100% market penetration in terms of awareness, and they're just making it live again. It's just harder than it used to be. Yes, I mean, there are more outlets for content, but it's a very hard time to sort of sell things. Like, I think it's hard to just sell a piece of material, right? Like, you've written something, you're a writer, you have a script, and your agent is going to take it out. Like, when I was coming up, if you wrote something on spec, you'd send it out to 15 different producers, right? And producers would jockey for territories that they could take it to try to sell it, right? So you might have one producer taking it to Warner Brothers, another producer taking it to, you know, to Sony, you know, and, you know, if you have any luck, like they all want it and there's a bidding war. Like, right. I've never had that experience. But it's how it used to be. And I think more and more, like, things have to be kind of packaged almost within an inch of their life. And even then, sometimes it doesn't work. Like, you'll hear of like a crazy package that goes out, you know, it's like J.J. Abrams and Julia Roberts and Tom Hanks, and they're all on this project. It's based on IP, and, you know, for whatever reason, it doesn't sell. I don't know exactly why that is, but I think that the business is expensive. And I think these places are getting more and more pragmatic about how they spend their money. So, you know, it's different than it used to be. There used to be like open writing assignment business, you know, a studio would have, you know, 140 projects in development set up with different producers that, you know, there's an ever-changing roster. It's like a, you know, pitching roster of writers on projects. Like when we wrote Tower Heist, we were the first writers in. We ended up with a half share of story by credit. There were 17 writers that worked on that project. You know, I mean, there were two that got screenplay credit on it. The business is very different, you know, and the studios don't make the studios themselves just don't make as many movies as they used to make.
Yeah.
You know, because in many cases, like the entertainment divisions are like 1% of a much larger conglomerate, you know?
Yeah.
And those, you know, it's just for the larger conglomerate, it's just a holding. So it's interesting.
To go off of that, I mean, I feel like that's why so many writers make a single go of it, because there's a lot of times people will approach a writer duo and kind of treat them as one writer. And so it gets harder, you know, like when you're sharing with another writer. Over the years, maybe your tastes diverge at some point, but you've had a pretty amazing writing career, writing a long time, as you mentioned, with one of your partners, Bill Collage. How did that kind of start, and how has it changed over the years, and what is your writing process like?
We met at the University of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And kind of, you know, forged the path together. He always lived in New York, and I lived here in Los Angeles. And then around the time of this movie, when we optioned the book, I really wanted to focus on directing it and sort of mounting that. And he really wanted to continue sort of pounding the pavement as being a writer. And so we kind of parted ways as writing partners. And he's gone on to have great success writing Emancipation and other things. But when we were working together, because we lived in different cities, we were never writers who were sitting in front of the computer together. We were always basically just trading scenes bi-coastally. That's how we would sort of build things. And I feel like that's more and more the norm. Like even writers I know who live in the same city, like my wife Liz is a writer, and she has a writing partner that's also here in Los Angeles. And they never sit in front of this computer together. They basically divide and conquer scenes. Or one of them might say, I'll write the first act. You write the first half of the second act, you know. But, you know, our process was always to just kind of keep hitting the ball back and forth, you know. Even if it was on a scene by scene level, like one of us might write one scene, send it to the other would make changes to it, rewrite it, and sort of send it back.
So you had mentioned before about, you know, being attached to direct other projects, like way earlier on in your career. And like that directing was kind of always like your goal, like from the beginning, but then it kind of shifted when you started doing more writing and everything. Why did it take all this time for the first feature to happen? Was it like just a series of attachments that just didn't work out? And then like in relying on the studio system, or was it other reasons? Like what was the, yeah, how did it all
I think there was a little bit of like a golden handcuffs of being a working writer, right? Yeah. Was sort of part of it. I had a young family, and I think that charting a course as a director is speculative and can be time consuming. Like, so I think that of the things that we were writing, I was never going to Exodus Gods and Kings or Assassin's Creed right. or any of these movies that yes. are like gigantic, nor is it really like my taste from like a directing standpoint, you know? Also, like, I think that I wouldn't know how to do it. I'm more drawn to sort of like a smaller dramatic narrative, right? Than I am composing that smaller dramatic narrative against a massive canvas. Like, I'm not drawn to superhero movies. It's just not my jam. I don't like begrudge them. I know people love them. I'm just more drawn to sort of characters in crisis. And so I think the reason it didn't happen is because it's probably twofold. Of the things that we were writing, there was, you know, really only one or two that I was compelled to want to direct. And I think also I was just in the business of being a writer and stopped attending to, you know, the notion of directing with a lot of drive, you know?
Yeah.
When you're making money and you tell your agent, hey, I want to pause on making money and figure out how to direct a movie, I think they support you in theory, but supporting you in practice is kind of a different thing. But
people like money.
But Bill was always really supportive of it. And I'm grateful for that.
Well, I wanted to ask you, you know, so now you've asked for the job, you got the job, you're on set. I do want to know, like, so you have Russell Crowe, like this amazing actor, and it sounded like he was a guy in your corner, you know, he was definitely there to help you and assist you. But I mean, how much experience had you had directing actors, or did you find much that you had to do much of that? Like, did your people just kind of show up and they knew what was going on?
I had experience directing actors in, like, you know, I took a lot of acting classes, but not because I wanted to be an actor, but because I wanted to know the craft and be able to sort of speak the language. I studied with a woman whose name was Judith Weston, who's great. It was called Acting for Directors. And, you know, did that kind of work. But in terms of like onset feature film directing, I'd done zero. But, you know, as it related to like Russell is such a pro and such a gifted actor. Directing Russell was largely action and cut. And more often than not, I didn't need more than one take for me, but it felt weird to not go again. So, you know, a lot of times if we had to go again, we had to go again for camera or for focus, not because we needed to appropriately calibrate Russell's performance. You know, like, he has incredible camera awareness. You know, I think, you know, we did develop sort of a language and a rhythm together where once I was happy, which was pretty quickly, I would ask him if he wanted another one. And on a rough handful of times, barely, maybe I had to sort of remind him of sort of an antecedent, you know, what came before the head of the scene that we're starting. But I don't know, maybe that was two times. You know, I didn't, you know, he's just a pro. He's just a pro. And I always just try to, with all of the actors, really approach it in the spirit of it being a collaborative experience. You know, same with the crew. Like, I didn't want it to be like, this is my story and I am the auteur. And, you know, I wanted everybody to be a storyteller. You know, everybody's telling their part of the story, either through their craft or through their performance. And, you know, I wanted it to be a place that was inspiring and that people were excited about the work they were doing, you know, because it's hard, I think, as your podcast says. You know, and so how do you make something that's hard pleasant, you know? And for me, that was making everybody feel like they're a part of it.
I we probably should get onto the last six questions, but I have to ask one more final question. So now that you've like gotten a taste for directing and you've made this big leap, you know, in your career from writer to director, especially with such a big movie with big stars and everything, is that the path forward, or are you going to go back to writing? And are you writing on your own now exclusively? Mm-hmm. Like, what's the next steps for you?
Well, I want to direct more things. I want to direct more things that I write. I want to write more things that maybe I don't direct. So kind of all three of those things.
Nice.
The stuff that I'm writing right now, I'm writing by myself. Though I did a show for Amazon, I don't know, 2 years ago that I wrote with another friend of mine. So, you know, I'm totally game to collaborate on, you know, on the right thing. I don't have, there's no hard and fast rule because, again, it's a collaborative medium.
Mm-hmm.
So I help friends of mine with their things all the time. They help me, you know. Yeah, I'd love to direct more things. And I've read, like, some people have sent me things as potential things to maybe direct. And I think I'll frankly have more luck directing something else that I write.
Yeah.
Well, now we're going to go into our final six questions. These are kind of rapid fire six questions. First one, what was the first film you ever made? And this could be, you know, a student project, something you made in high school for a book report or something like that. And how do you feel about it now?
The first thing I ever made was a thing called Convenience Store Cowboys. It was a short documentary about people who shop at places like Stop and Shop and 7-Eleven. And I did it my sophomore year of college. And I don't know how I feel about it now because I haven't looked at it. I don't even know where that is. It's probably like, it's in a format that I don't think I even have an ability to play. I don't know what it is. But I did it, like, my partner in the class was this guy named Carlo Bernard, who is actually one of the co-creators of Narcos.
Oh wow.
That's amazing. What's the best filmmaking advice you've ever received?
I think just be open to it not being how you originally imagined.
Mm. Nice. Good one. And conversely, what is the worst filmmaking advice you've ever received?
Don't worry, you have plenty of time.
Oh, that's funny. Do you have a goal as a filmmaker?
Yeah, I'd love to just, be it in writing or directing or writing and directing, to just make more things that move people, make things where people see something of themselves in, you know, in the characters or any given character.
If you could go back in time and give young Adam Cooper one bit of advice, what would it be?
Have more confidence.
Really?
And last question, is making movies hard?
Yes, but it's fun.
Good answer.
Nice. Now tell us where people can go see the movie. How should they support you? What should they do?
So Sleeping Dogs comes out in theaters March 22nd. I think you can see it in every major market. I know that Collider recently dropped some kind of sweepstakes where you could win free tickets to see it early on March 14th at the Landmark Sunset in Los Angeles, followed by a Q&A with myself and Karen Gillan. And I guess other ways you can help is you can say really nice things about it and tell your friends to go see it.
So, without further delay, here is this week's Ask the Expert. What is Ask the Expert, you say? What is this thing that we're doing? It's a segment devised by our producer, Eric Toms, where he comes up with a question that he knows Liz and I are going to be the absolute experts in. So we get to read these ahead of time. We get to, like, think about them and ruminate. So we've seen this question and we think we have good answers. So here we go. I recently got distribution for my first indie feature. I got a decent deal, but as expected, no money up front. I want to trust my distribution partners, but I also want to keep an eye on the numbers so as to ensure any profits that would be owed to me. How long should I check up on revenue reports?
Always. A good distributor will disperse revenue reports quarterly. Some will send them out even more frequently, like I'm talking to BitMax, and BitMax reports more frequently than quarterly. Some do it biannually, but they should be regularly updating you with how your film has been doing, how your title's been doing, and you should never stop. I have seen accounting errors. They were done not purposefully. A lot of these mistakes are not done purposefully. They're just mistakes, but real money is attached to that carelessness. You should always check the work. Check their work.
I don't really have anything to add to that except, yeah, just quarterly seems pretty standard. And, you know, sometimes they come in a little late because people are busy, which has happened to me a couple of times. But I've always gotten my reports from my distributor. And I don't think I've ever, well, maybe the first one I was like, where's my report? Shouldn't it be? And he's like, oh, it's coming in this date. And he told me that when I should expect it. And then it came when he said. So it was good communication. It was a good thing. you know, it's just that they're, it's tough for the new filmmakers. When you see your quarterly report, you might be like, huh, oh, that's too bad. I wish I would have made more money.
Yeah, just because it's low doesn't mean you're owed more, but just double check the numbers. Double check the math.
Yeah.
But it's low for everyone. No one's making money. Let's just be honest about that.
But if they're not giving you reports for whatever reason, that's definitely a huge red flag. So make sure that you're getting some sort of regular statement from your distributor for sure. And with that, you know, let us know if you guys have any other suggestions, comments, or thoughts on distributors giving you their statements. What's the worst situation you ever had and the best situation you ever had? Tell us. Let us know. You can send an email to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com, or if you really like the show, you can leave us a review on iTunes, which we would love. Also, check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at MMIH Podcast, and YouTube at Making Movies Is Hard Podcast. Thanks to Adam Cooper for coming on the show. Thanks to Sam Anaya from Katrina Wam PR for setting this up. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Reimut, for doing the editing. Thanks to Robert Jones for handling all of our social media. And thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for being awesome. Thanks to you all for listening, and we'll talk to y'all next week. The other thing going on with me...
Is this child being unhappy?
Well, he's... Because his sister... Let him play with the toy. You can't. It's not just your toy. It's his toy too. Okay, sorry guys. This is like the most the most heavy life version of kids coming into podcasts ever.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.